The Journey to Joy, Part 3, Matthew.
So this week, in movie theaters across America, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader was released. Now, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is the fifth book in C.S. Lewis's incredibly creative Tales of Narnia series. And if you remember, the most famous of that is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Well, in the Dawn Treader, the Narnia's best ship is set to sail, and our familiar characters, Lucy and Edmund and Eustace, set sail with the Dawn Treader to go to the ends of the earth. So, if you know anything about C.S. Lewis, in this incredible journey, he goes from island to island where they encounter dragons and magicians and a thing called a duffel pod. I have no idea what a duffel pod is. Here's what it looks like, though. It's a one-footed creature. C.S. Lewis's imagination is amazing. And basically, it sleeps on its back. I'm not going to try that for you here. So that it can stay out of the elements, the sun, the wind. And in this incredible story that C.S. Lewis tells, of course, C.S. Lewis tells all these metaphors and images of who God is. So in this story with the duffel pods, the duffel pods are made invisible by the evil magician. And so the duffel pods capture Lucy and all their friends. And basically, Lucy is asked to go up to the magician's magic book and to erase this spell so that the duffel pods can be duffel pods once again. So Lucy climbs up the dark stairway through the dark hallways. And then Lucy encounters the magic book. And as she turns the pages of that magic book, she's enthralled. She's caught up because it's telling her a story of beauty, a story of truth, a story of justice. And then she quickly forgets the story. And she moves on and she cures the duffel pods and they celebrate with a great feast. But then she encounters Aslan. Now, Aslan in the Tales of Narnia is the great lion who's a figure for Christ. He is mighty, but he's compassionate. He is always present, but he's hard to find. So when you read this amazing seven-book trilogy that C.S. Lewis, you are always like, where's Aslan going to come? When is Aslan going to make things right? Where is God going to come into this situation? And so she sees Aslan and she's overjoyed with that sense of young adult wonder. And she says these words. She says, shall I ever be able to read that story again? The one I couldn't remember? Will you tell it to me, Aslan? Oh, do. And Aslan, the great lion, replies, indeed, yes, I will tell it to you for years and years. But now come, we must meet the master of this house. I will tell it to you for years and years. This is a metaphor for how God continues to tell us the story of love over and over and over. Through the beauty that we see around us, through good friends and compassionate neighbors, through a timely note card of encouragement in a hard season of life. And, of course, through the Christmas carols that we all love and sing so much, God is telling us over and over again, you are loved, you are accepted, you are worthy, you are beloved. And, of course, we have another gift, the gift of the Bible. And we overhear the Bible stories to us and we're pointed beyond ourselves to who God is, who God could possibly be. And so there needs to be a kind of like clarification of what's going on. So the Bible is not a punching glove that we punch one another with. The Bible is not a 2,412-page burden that we carry around. That's the number of pages in my study Bible. The Bible is not just a sense of simply a rule book. The Bible is an epic story. The Bible is an adventure that invites every one of us to live out this love to this world that desperately needs to see this love in action. So, in Advent, we've been looking at the opening scene of every single gospel. We looked at Mark and we learned about confessing. We learned about confessing these ways where we haven't loved God and loved each other. And then, of course, we looked at Luke and we learned about what Jesus set in motion way over here and what Jesus brought to fulfillment way over here, a new earth, a new world, no crying, no pain. But we live right in the middle. The baton has been passed to us and now we are running to this place, this new earth, this new world where we make right the wrongs that we see, where there's no more pain. We are in this awesome continuum of history. And now we come to a genealogy. Now, many of you may think that a genealogy sits beside the bed as, time to go to sleep, a potion to go to sleep for boredom. But you need to understand, genealogies, one clarification. So genealogies in the ancient world, they're not so much concerned with where someone is from as who that person is. So in our world, a genealogy is simply a historical antiquarian search for our heritage. In the ancient world, it was who this person is. Who is the person that this became? So, to evidence that, here is the first sentence in the Gospel of Matthew. The genealogical record book of King Jesus. David's son, as well as Abraham's. So what these amazing New Testament authors do is they pack a whole lot of meaning into one or two words. So right away, the genealogical record book. Genealogical could also be Genesis. So again, paralleling that great account in Genesis where God created the heavens and the earth, mimicking that same word and allowing us to remember that Jesus is creating something new. Jesus is restoring, rebinding, refreshing, renewing our lives. A big time claim here. And then it goes on to say, David's son. Now the son of David, you have to go look at that amazing story, but the son of David is a whole history of David becoming king. So this Jesus is going to become a king. This Jesus is going to recreate the world, and then the son of Abraham. If you remember, Abraham is one who's called by God and sent to go to the world. He's promised that his descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky. It's meant for all the world. It's global in perspective. So with one sentence, Gospels are amazing. Great literature, especially in a year when the Broncos are so poor. But anyway, the beginning record book of King Jesus, David's son, as well as Abraham's. Simply said, this is a big time story about how God is going to make right the wrongs of this world and come to our world as a king. So of course, all of us are like, what does that mean? What type of king comes to our world? And we have the rest of the genealogy, all 17 verses. So, get comfortable because we're going to be here for 4 more hours. Just joking. So we can't go through everything in this genealogy today, but something comes out that's very striking. And I'll show it to you. So in this ancient genealogy, 5 women are named. Tamar is named. Rahab is named. Ruth is named. Bathsheba is named. And of course, Mary is named. Now you have to remember, in the ancient world, for women to be named, that's revolutionary. This is a day where men ruled with an iron fist. We've gotten smarter since that period of time. And this text says that, remember, it's about who Jesus is, not so much exactly historical data. Somehow, Jesus is echoed or foreshadowed by these women, by Tamar, by Rahab, by Ruth, by Bathsheba, and by Mary. And of course, the question that burns in our hearts is, how in the world do these women foreshadow the Jesus that is to come, the King of love? I have a confession to make to you as we move onward. I am a man. I know that's hard for some of you to recognize, but I am a man, And so I have lived with my mom. There's a picture of my mom in a good relationship for 31 years. I've lived with Stacy, been married for 7 years. And I have a beautiful baby daughter who I've lived with in good relations for 18 months. Okay? All this is to say, women are powerful. I've learned two things. Women are powerful, and men, this is really for you, not for them. The next thing is, we will never be able to comprehend them. The second thing I've learned about women is, women are mysterious and surprising. Men, what this means, they cannot be categorized or fit neatly into our boxes. Now you wonder why I've shared this. I'm about to share shortly with you the story of five women. These are my humble observations, but in no way is it exhaustive. Surely every one of you women could add a lot more than I can this morning. And if we had 5 to 8 hours, we could do that. So I offer you my humble observations on these women. Take with them what you will. So the first woman, Tamar. Okay, very interesting that every single one of these women has something kind of sketchy about their sexual past. It's in the Bible. I didn't make that up. Go read it yourself. We're not going to talk about all the details. Because as a man, I'm uncomfortable to talk about those. So what happens in with Tamar is Tamar marries Judah's son. Er is his name. Er. And what happens is that Er ends up not being a very good guy, and eventually he dies. So Tamar is left without a son, without a daughter. And in the ancient world, this is a really big deal because the lineage was carried on by sons and daughters. And so there is a thing called a levirate marriage. Okay, you can look this up in Deuteronomy if you don't believe me. When brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So just so we're on the same page, in a Middle Eastern ancient context, when an older brother dies, the middle or younger brother takes the duties, does something to get their wife pregnant so that the line can be passed on. I asked the Rhodes family, who spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and this is still a practice in some villages in the Middle East. I was going to show a picture of my sister-in-law and explain it that way, but that just is not good. It's awkward in all kinds of ways. So you get the point of what's going on here. So this is the legal practice of the ancient world. This just is what it is. Some people ask me afterwards, do you recommend that? No. So this is what they did. And so poor Tamar, she's under the household of Judah. Her husband dies. She has no son, no daughter. So Judah says, okay, my second son, Onan, can do what they do to have another baby. And of course, Onan does something very disrespectful. You can read it in Genesis 38, and there's no baby. So Onan has disrespected Tamar and disrespected Judah and disrespected his brother in this culture. Okay, so then look at Tamar. Tamar has been used by the father-in-law Judah. She's been used by her husband and now used by her brother. But she still lives in the house of Judah. Imagine day after day, performing the woman's duties and the cooking and the cleaning and whatnot that would happen in a household system, and being robbed of that privilege of having a son or a daughter because the family has made this big joke out of it. So then she's told, oh, just wait your turn. We'll give you the youngest son, Shelah. Okay, but that never happens. So there she is to sit and rot away for the rest of her life. So she decides to take things into her own hand, and she, when Judah's wife dies, that's her father-in-law, she goes down to the local town. She covers her face and dresses as a prostitute of the day would dress. And of course, you know Judah's character by this time in the story. Judah, right after his wife has died, propositions her, okay? And he says, we know Tamar is smart. Tamar says, please give me your signet ring, which is basically your credit card in the ancient world because it's stamped approval on things, and give me your walking cane, which was your driver's license of the ancient world. So this smart woman says, give me, you know, smart women in the Bible here. So give me your credit card and your driver's license. And then, of course, I don't know what happens, but 3 months later, a baby comes to Tamar. And the household is upset, and Judah says, burn her. And of course, Tamar says, you might want to wait a second on that. And so with this amazing story located in the Bible, we see that Tamar has acted in line with the customs. It's the men of the house who were not acting in line. And at the end of the story, the summation of the story, Judah says this, she is right and I am not. Remember, men, these are not words we say often. This man understood how wrong he was. He was caught. So from the example of Tamar, we overhear what this king, this baby, will be like. And then we come to Rahab. Now, Rahab is a foreigner. She's not an Israelite. She's not in the club of the Israelite family. So basically what happens is that there's a city that the Israelites are planning to take over. They go to the city and they meet up with Rahab. And of course, Rahab is also a prostitute, a woman of low social status. And these spies say, help us out, you know, whatever the exchange is. And then the king of this land comes to Rahab and says, tell us who these spies are, give up their location. So Rahab is caught in this amazing tension. Do I obey my king or do I believe these spies? So Rahab, in this real moment, she tells the king, I don't know where they are. I don't know where they went. She lets the spies escape. But the spies say, thank you for showing us this kindness and sparing our lives. When we take over the land, we will remember you. And then you hear the amazing, Rahab's amazing motivation. She says, please, don't harm my brothers and my sisters and my cousins and my nephews. She's concerned about her family. And they say, tie a crimson cord around your door and nothing will happen to you. So what is that story about? In this awesome moment, she has to choose between the king of her land or the king that is coming into the world. And she chooses to believe in a king that will make things better for her, that will lift her and her family out of this lifestyle of prostitution and create a world where everyone has worth and dignity and love. Incredible. And from her, we overhear the echoes of the baby of love that is coming into the world. And then we come, of course, to one of the most amazing stories in the Bible, 4 chapters on Ruth. Okay, and simply, Ruth is the daughter-in-law to sons. They both die. But Naomi also had daughter-in-laws. And she tells the daughter-in-laws, go back to your land. You're Moabites. You'll find men there. You're young. And one of them, Orpah, she does. She goes back. And who could blame her? But the other one, Ruth, says this. Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. This is amazing loyalty. Maybe one of the most incredible loyal passages in all of Western literature. Again, a daughter-in-law says, I don't want to go back home. I want to go with you and your God. You've taught me something about life, and I want to press on with you. And of course, you know the amazing story. She is clever and crafty and creative and finds Boaz. And then they have a baby. And of course, we learn from Ruth about the echoes of that baby that is to come. And then we come to Bathsheba. Now, we all know Bathsheba, or else we should. Bathsheba is king, the one King David had a baby with, that he committed adultery. Well, we want to look at this story from Bathsheba's perspective. So the king comes knocking and something happens and a baby comes and there's a miscarriage. And then the king, King David, to make right of his wrongs, sends Uriah to the front line of the battle and Uriah is killed. So Bathsheba loses a baby. Bathsheba loses a husband who, from all accounts, is a courageous, good man. And then, of course, she has another son. So you can imagine. And also I remind you that David has 5 other wives. That was the practice at the time. And so Bathsheba loses a beloved husband, a beloved son, and then finally has a son, Solomon. And Solomon is the promised new king to come. And at the end of David's life, some men don't learn. And at the end of David's life, David has a young maiden come and comfort him in the nightly hours. Okay, read what you will into that Bible. David, shame on you. I mean, can't we learn along the way? David had like 10 chances here. That was free. Back to the story. So then at this moment, David has let this woman into his room. Now remember, how does Bathsheba feel about this, you know? And so there's this woman there, and then all of a sudden David says, well, we're going to let just so-and-so be the king. And so Bathsheba's like, the hopes of my son, the way I have raised him, everything I've put my heart into, you're going to make that person a king just because of this fling? No, no, mister. So Bathsheba swallows all her pride, enters into the royal courts, into his bedroom, and bows at his feet. Remember, it's ancient kings, and says something different. Maybe a slap. David needs a slap, huh? Bow at his feet and says, King David, remember your promises for my son. To David's credit, he awakens and he says, yes, you're right, I've been wrong. And King Solomon is crowned the king of Israel. Think about the courage of Bathsheba to go before King David. We hear echoes of the king to come through this woman. And lastly, we come to Mary, the one most of us know. And of course, the passage tells us that all this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. Now, you need to know something about that Hebrew verb, the virgin. It's controversial. It could be translated as young woman, young girl, or virgin. So there's a lot of room here. But at the end of the day, what happens is that she's in a marriage contract to Joseph, and all of a sudden, there is a baby in the picture. So Joseph does the honorable thing in Matthew and knows that something special is coming. But Mary has to endure that gossip from the other women, that gossip from the other men. Her life is kind of scarred by this. What was really going on with that little baby in your tummy? And Mary is courageous enough to birth the king that will set a spin of love to the entire global world. So what do we learn from these echoes? We learn a lot. We learn that in the midst of ordinary, everyday life, women do extraordinary things. Extraordinary small things that echo across history and give birth to incredible things. One thing that's amazing to me that I observed this week is that in every one of these stories, the word hased. Remember? God's steadfast love. Hased is one of those words. Awesome. Hased is one of those words that takes 10 English words and puts it into one. So it means all these things. Committed loyalty, kindness. Hased is what God brings to us. Every one of these women foreshadowed that hased in different ways. And I would tell you that every single one of these women are a foreshadow, a forerunner to God who risks it all for a baby to come, for a king of love. So every one of these women offer risks of love to our world. They show us these incredible examples. They boost us up and say, wow, we could live like that. And they show us who God is. God is someone who is incredibly risky with love, to love every single one of us. To put that love in a baby, to let him grow, to let him to start a new kind of kingdom. So, in the midst of winter, in the midst of sorrow and pain, in the midst of sorrow and pain, God breaks forth a beautiful flower, a Christmas cactus for all of us. Amen.